Well, hello, and welcome to another episode of Gaming from the First Age. My name is First Age, not really, and I am here, well, reassuringly, to talk about tabletop role-playing games for a while, and I'm very glad that you will join me. But most of all, today, Jak komarat vardin spieleledare. That's right, today I will be your game leader, because today we're going to look at a very special, very nice tabletop role-playing game that is Swedish, and it's not Free League, it's Helmgast, and it's Hjaltarnas Tild. Join me now in the sauna as we consider this basic role-playing game perfected, or is it? Hello, I hope you're well, and I hope you are enjoying your gaming hobby just as much as I am. Well, I found myself, halfway through 2023. It's been a good gaming year for me so far, and it's taken some unexpected turns. It's nice when that happens, and this one certainly is unexpected. Hjaltarnas Tild. Now, that's roughly translated, and excuse my non-Swedish, as the time of, or the age of, heroes. So my Swedish fantasies, which we've already explored, and I'm sure you probably hoped that you'd sort of come to the end of them. Well, no, it carries on. I clearly must have some Swedish DNA. It's been further extended to this light and inventive take on basic role-playing, the Chaosium classic game that goes way back, way back. My second game was the 1981 edition of, I think it was first edition of RuneQuest, which obviously made use of the basic role-playing engine. So this is Hjaltarnas Tild, Age of Heroes, Helmgast. Perhaps Helmgast is better known to us in English-speaking climes for the game Cult Divinity Lost, superb game. But also, I suppose, game-wise or rules-wise, the successor game to Hjaltarnas Tild, which is The Troubleshooters, sort of a 1960s Franco-Belgian comic-style adventure game. One that I haven't, to my embarrassment, yet picked up and read, but apparently it inherits a great deal of the Hjaltarnas Tild game mechanics. So if you're playing The Troubleshooters, you probably already know a little bit about what is to come. But let me talk to you a bit about my journey with Hjaltarnas Tild. Without any translation available in English, this became my first foreign language RPG purchase. I bought the Swedish PDF. I was enamoured by the description of the basic role-playing style in a thread on RPG.net, wherever. And it talked about, you know, Hjaltarnas Tild, is this basic role-playing perfected? Well, that caught my eye. Is it? Well, we'll find out. Now, there were a few moments, and probably no more, where I vacillated on the prospect of a personal translation of this game via, mostly, Google Translate. How quick would it be? How much text scraping? How comprehensible would the result even be? Could I actually play from the translation? Now, Translate itself has a limit of about 10 megabytes, and the file was likely to be larger than that. It was. Oh well, I would step forward with a purchase to discover. Now, the PDF itself was no more than a tenner, so it's not really a big risk. If it didn't work out, oh well, never mind. Silly me, I've got a very nice PDF that I can't read. But let's see how that translation process worked. I'm going to talk first of all about the translation, and then I'm going to talk about the game. So I have myself a PDF copy of Hjaltarnas Tild. Very nice. 137 pages, nicely laid out. And in fact, the layout of this PDF was itself a stumbling block for the translation. My conversion method was to open the PDF, but open it in Google Docs, not in a PDF reader, and then use, from the Google Docs menu, Tools, Translate, to shunt the text into English on a Google Doc. Now, this was a little ungainly, as I had to split the PDF to get all of this done. But in the end, I had a first stab at the text, though some of it was rather obscured by the aforementioned formatting exertions in the more complex laid-out pages from the source PDF. Not only that, I discovered, a little belatedly, that certain elements of the layout wasn't OCR-style text. It was graphics with text on it. And to be fair, there wasn't very much that Google Docs could do about that. So there are chunks of the game, not very sizable chunks, but some, where Google Docs just politely ignored it. No worries. I mean, I had enough to start to look at the game and enjoy what I had purchased. And I sensed I probably had enough. So the translation went pretty well on the whole. There were some elements of it that didn't perhaps quite come out right. So there's a skill called, for example, marksmanship. That was got translated to Sagittarius. And it just took me a few moments to sort of realise what it was doing there. And there are, I suppose, some things where there's a very literal translation which actually doesn't capture the essence of what the game is actually trying to say. And to a degree, I'm still slightly unpicking about that, that's around the edges. But the translation was definitely good enough for me to get going. As much as anything else, it has two supplements. One, the Weave of Magic, and the other, sort of the Path of Heroes, or that's the translation of those two. And they're both well worth getting as well. One, I think, expands really upon the character options that you have, and the other expands upon the magic and the spells. The great thing about both these things, although they obviously call into the core book, they've actually brought and dragged the core book into those supplements. So actually they kind of work as a whole. If you want to look at magic, you go to the Weave of Magic. You don't really have to go to the core book again because it's all in there. So it's quite nicely done. So I got all three of those PDFs and translated all three to give me a more rounded text. Of course, what that did give me was even more text where there were some rough edges. And so I had to do a bit more than a simple scrape and translate. What else did I have to do? Well, apart from anything else, there's some very nice Swedes out there, including actually the author of the game, who very kindly gave me some tips on translation. So I'm in a better place now in some of those little sort of thorny areas where I wasn't really 100% sure whether I was getting the right gist of things, and I got set straight on the translation, which in itself was really, really good. But my approach had to be a little bit more than that because I wanted it to be fairly slick and smooth. So obviously I had to create a character sheet. I created that in Google Docs so I could quickly print it out, fill it in and print it out, in fact, and make it available and share it. I think the other thing that I probably had to do was, for certain key areas, I had to drag the text out of the translated document into a new document and kind of work through it again, this time doubling down on some of the meaning so that I had a cleaner and more straightforwardly understandable text in front of me, rather than having to sort of semi-translate the skill names again and all that kind of thing. So I had those. So I built a sort of a document primer that gives all the core rules of the game in a very small number of pages, which again was something that I could share. Most recently, I've taken all the spells out of the Web of Magic supplement. And I've taken the translation and I've gone through those a little bit more to get better understanding. And then I've put it all into Publisher and laid it out as a PDF. So I've got what I suppose you might call a grimoire for Yaltana's Tild as a separate document that's translated. And again, available for my players. And I'm going to do some more work like that. The magical traditions are usefully, I think, going to be pulled out as sort of one-pagers. So if someone decides to be a mage in the game, they want to pick a tradition, I can give them effectively a page. So it's an ongoing process. Yes, they're translated. Yes, allowing for some of the gaps and some of the slightly off translations, there was more than enough to understand the game. Phew, I haven't wasted my money. Of course, it needs to be played, and I'll come to that as well. I'll now talk a little bit about the actual game itself and what I found after I'd unmangled myself from my own Google translation. So, Hjaltanes Tild, the actual game. Well, I like what I've found. This is the revised and updated version of the game. It includes all the elements in the original box. As I say, it's 137 pages. Perfect size game for me, really. It's not too big, it's just right. And it's got all the components that you need. Yes, there are two supplements, and they are very, very useful. You do not need them. You can play it all with the core game. And that's true, I think, of the KSR movement all round. KSR being classic Swedish roleplay. And I'll talk about that probably in another podcast, but it's probably in line with what you might expect from a nicely put together Swedish role-playing game. So it's not too much, and indeed just enough to get to know it quickly to consider whether I would really get it to the table. I did. Perhaps excited by the re-emergence of Chaosium's big gold book, which is now out, of basic role-playing, which of course now comes with an open license, which is great. Revised, reformatted. I became, well, as is typical of me, sidetracked by this much earlier iteration, riven deep in the Scandi tradition, with tendrils intersecting to Trudvang, Forbidden Lands, and Dragonbane, at the very least. So, Hjaltanes Tild, roughly translated as Age of Heroes, has all the base core of what I would call a basic role-playing game that you would expect, and as such takes me home and back to those 1980s game playing that I used to do, back to my core and the beginning. It's a core rule system, very much defined by my early formative playing. The familiar D100 skills were there, though with a different number and a different labels. I think there's 27 adventuring skills and 8 combat skills. We are taken to some perhaps earlier 1980s RPG design with copious numbers, far higher than modernity would deem entirely wise when it comes to skills. It's a lot less than, you know, RuneQuest Glorantha, of course, but that's not really saying anything, is it? So the game may have basic role-playing DNA, as in it's a skill-based game, D100, equal to or less than your skill, but it has taken many new directions that spice up the old faithful nicely. And as I say, if you're familiar with the relatively new The Troubleshooters RPG, then you know what this game is all about, being developed and produced by the same designer and company. The designer feels he got it fully right with Troubleshooters. So, what makes this iteration of a trusted game engine so special? Well, here are some highlights, and perhaps by going through these highlights, it will highlight why the game works for me and will perhaps inform you as to whether it's your kind of game or not. It has skills. It has, as I say, quite a number of them, but it doesn't have attributes. The attributes have been folded into skills. So those old 3d6 set of attributes that we once knew are gone and replaced by skill percentages as other skills to be used in challenges straight away. So strength, for example, is a skill. Willpower is a skill. Dexterity is a skill. And you can increase them in the same way. I'll come to perhaps a little bit to increases later. So you've got your skills. You've got a D100 mechanic equal to or less than your skill for a success. But it does a bit more than that. Doubles and blackjack. So a success is under your skill. An outstanding success will be a success, but the dice come up doubles. A woeful failure is greater than your skill, and the dice come up doubles. It's got levels of success built into the dice roll. And you can just tell that straight by looking at the dice. Doubles mean something straight away. Again, not necessarily new. You can find some of these things in other games, but it's nice to bring it together. And that's going to be a running theme with this game. It's got lots of nice touches throughout. Here's an interesting one. And this kind of gets rid of modifiers. So one of the things about basic role playing is, you know, you can have something where it says, well, this is an easy check. Oh, well, you're at plus 20%, you know. Well, this is a challenging role, you know, then you're at minus 20% or something like that. So you having skill modifiers is, I suppose, a part of the historic design of basic role-playing, but not here. So here, I'm going to call it, well, my interpretation is open and closed difficulties. So a standard role is required in a challenging situation. Now, if the circumstances allow it, it might be an easier situation. And in this case, It's called, I'm going to call it, for the purposes of this podcast, an open roll. And you open it usually by one or two steps. Now, if it were two steps, it was an, if I declare it to be an open two roll, then if you roll and fail, but the digit die of your percentage dice is a one or two, then you actually succeed. If yet more difficult, then you can close the roll. Again, let's say by two steps. Then if you roll and succeed, but your digit die on your percentage is a one or a two, then you actually still fail. No modifiers, just an interpretation of the digit die. In play, and I have managed to get this to the table, I'm glad to say, it's elegant. It works very, very well. You can open more. You can open, I think, up to about a plus five. I mean, arguably, you can open up to a nine, in which case you're almost certainly going to succeed. But I suggest that typically you're playing one, two, and up to five for a very simple or very, very difficult roll. But that's, again, a range that you can use. Elegant and a little bit different. So you're doing a lot with the D100. But at the same time, your initial interpretation of it is very, very quick. So it's not cognitively complex. It's reasonably intuitive. And the dice are doing a lot. And that, for me, is a great combination in a sort of dice mechanic. Your characters have traits and relationships. So these are narrative pieces of text that can be expended during a game session. So a trait would be something like impulsive. I tend to use them as one-worders. Honest, lovelorn, traits. And these principally are there as, I think you can have up to five of them. They're kind of there to give you a handle on your character. So it's personality, really. And it gives you a hook to play. That's their principal reason. You have relationships with the other characters, or possibly with something around you. Like it might be a relationship with your home city or your partner. And you have four or five of those, I think. So they're really good because they give some pithy flavour to your character. But these traits and relationships also have a part to play and can be used as a narrative currency. And that currency can affect and support you if you fail a dice roll. So if you can weave one of these traits or relationships during a game session into a dice roll that's failed, you can tick the traits or tick the relationship off. So that's been used for this game session, and you get to flip the D100 dice. So your tens become units and your units become tens. So suddenly that 83 roll that you rolled becomes a 38. And that could be enough, clearly, to make a big difference. Or maybe it's a 77, in which case you're stuffed. So that's a nice thing. If it's one of the doubles, you're stuck with a double. You can't flip it. And, you know, either it's great or it's rubbish. So you get those, and that currency refreshes in the next session. So you're using your traits and your relationships as a way of driving success in play. Again, doing a lot with the dice, but not too much. Guard and health. So one of the things about basic role playing, and it's true of this game as well, is that it's kind of, it's thought of as a little bit gritty because you don't have this swelling sack of hit points. Well, in BRP, vulnerability is a part of it. It's a part of, you have to think very hard, long and hard maybe, about, you know, do you want to get involved in a combat, for example? Because, well, in RuneQuest, if you had 10 hit points and three of them in your limbs, and you get chopped in a limb, well, goodbye your left leg. That's one of the things. This game is similar, but a little bit different again. So you've got something else. You've got something called guard and health. And guard, I guess, gives another impetus to the game. Health is similar to hit points. So they're the physical health of your character. They don't replenish very quickly. They come back, you know, a few points a day. So it's a gradual recovery. There are other ways of recovering your health using magic and healing arts and so on. But you haven't got a huge amount of them either. It tends to be, well, it tends to be around about 20. Can be a bit less, can be a bit more. And when you've got, you know, a weapon doing 4d6 damage, and I'll come back to weapon damage in a moment, you know, it's tight. And you've got some armor, which is going to absorb and protect you. But nevertheless, you have to be a little bit careful. Guard is an interesting one. It's fortune, it's impetus, it's defensive thinking, it's knowledge of fighting, it's a whole range of concepts, really. It's an abstraction. And guard, you've got about a similar number to health. And depending on the type of role, you will tend to be damaged by your guard first before your health. And guard replenishes fully at the end of the combat encounter. So it's a way of buffering your health. If you are on the receipt of a outstanding success attack and it wins the combat and you're damaged, that goes straight off your health. So it's not always there for you, but it is there for the vast majority of the time. You can occasionally use guard to fire up and use your talents, which I'll come to in a second. So guard is damaged first before the slowly replenishing health is touched. And you can actually increase your health and guard up to a specific amount. And to do that, you need to roll after an adventure. So not after a game session, but after the closure of an adventure. And that might be coterminous with the end of a session, but it isn't necessarily. And you need to roll greater than or equal to or greater than your guard to increase it by one. And for health, you need to roll equal to or greater than double your health to increase it by one. So that kind of self-limits how quickly and how much either health or guard will increase. But it has for me just enough to give a very slightly more survivable and heroic character in a classic basic role-playing context. And I like that. It works very, very well. Debt. Quite a lot of us have got debt. This is magical debt. Wizards have to struggle with the damage that they cause to the natural order when they cast their rending spells and they rip holes in the weird. The weird being the sort of magical energy that permeates this world and the other world. And this debt is accumulated when spells are cast. A wizard's threshold is equal to their weird skill. So you find wizards who have a very good weird skill because they understand the other world, they understand magical energy, and they need it because that's how many points they've got each spell. And a spell will have a cost of 1, 2, 3, d6 worth of debt. And the debt accumulates. So you have to find a way of purging yourself of this debt. And each magical tradition has a different way of purging debt. And so a mage's response to their magic is very, very tied into the tradition in which they have learnt their magic. Very nice. If they transgress this limit, if they go over their weird skill with debt, then they become almost wraith-like and locked in the other world, a very dangerous realm. And if not captured or brought back, they can be trapped there. So the magic in this game is nicely conceived and described. It has a logic, but a logic that is riven around different worlds and the collision between them. It's well done. It's quite nice. The spells themselves are just spells. But again, you get guidance on how to make your own. Seems to work pretty well. The game has zones. It doesn't have specific and precise ranges. So it kind of operates on a theatre of the mind basis, mostly. And zones, areas define the battlefield, and they can be fairly flexible. I like that, and it's done quite well. You have to think about what the zones are, but it works pretty well. Weapon damage is D6. So the game is actually a D100 and D6 game only. It doesn't have all the polyhedral sets. I actually kind of like that as well. So the D6, as I say, a spear is about 4D6. I think a longsword is 5D6. Damage explodes. So if you get a 6 on any of these D6s when you roll them for damage, you pick up another die and roll again. I can hear already the screams of exultation and despair as exploding dice take place in play. Armor is, as I say, is rolled, soak for protection. I think a heavy armor is up to about 3d6. So it'll protect you a bit, but you're still going to get cut down if you can't parry. A lot of the skill mechanics are based around contests. So sort of like an opposed role. So it's a bit like Pendragon in that sense, and indeed other games. So if you have a combat situation, somebody attacks, you can make a reaction. And you can make as many reactions as you like in a turn. So it doesn't penalise you at all. I had wondered about making it grittier and closing the roll by one for every parry after the first that you make. Yeah, I kind of like that in a sort of a grim and dangerous... But maybe if I'm running a more grim and dangerous game, I might go for that. But the way it works is it's a contest. So you both roll. And if you both succeed, the parry and the attack succeed, and the one that rolls the highest wins. So even if you make your parry, if your opponent succeeds too, but rolls higher than you, then you fail and you'll be damaged. So there's a real danger to combat. But again, that works quite well. And this opposed contest idea is used quite frequently, I would say. It's used often to oppose, often magic versus willpower is a common one when you're trying to resist the effects of another sorcerer. Quite nice. It does make things much more difficult to succeed if you've got an opposed roll. But again, you've got that flip, that dice flip available to you, which again, tactically I've seen in play now, where somebody succeeds, but they don't succeed by enough. And if they flip the dice, then they succeed by more than the opponent, and therefore they win. So there's a little bit of playing with the dice as you go, but again, not that much. You can quickly interpret it. Oh, I've definitely failed. No, wait a minute, I can do something. I'll do that instead. Okay, describe it. Bang, we're in, and you win. So again, quite good. And a little bit heroic. You know, it's got a little bit of heroic. You could decide to make it more complex and more gritty if you wanted to in all sorts of places. So I like the game. I have played it out a few times. Oh, and experience, by the way. Sorry, experience. I should say experience is familiar to those of you who do basic role-playing. At the end of a game session, any skill that you've used appropriately, whether you succeed or failed in it, you sort of tick it. And then you make skill rolls at the end of a session. If you roll equal to or higher than your skill, then your skill increments by plus 1d6 percentage points. And that's how it goes right through up to about 106, you know, if you happen to have maximized out at that. It also has a, what should we call them? I think lore points or learning points, development points, if you like. And these can be used to buy talents, languages and spells and things like that. So the game does. So characters do have talents, which are kind of linked to your archetypes. And so you've got some thematic drawing down of sort of niche types of abilities, but it's nicely done. It's lightly done. And do you know, I can't remember. I should have checked, but it might be that everyone can buy every talent, but if it's in your profession, in your archetype, it's cheaper. It's one of those ones where it's like a, you know, how far do you really want to push yourself out of your natural mindset, as it were. But it works well. So I've played it, I've run it, and I'll talk a little bit about how it played at the table. Thank goodness, I think is probably what you're thinking. Thank goodness. After all that effort, he has actually got the game to the table and played it. Thank goodness for that. I mean, how embarrassing would it have been to have done all that and it would have just been for, well, I'm going to say nothing. It's never for nothing, is it? But at least I've got it to the table. Two contexts. The first was UK Games Expo, where I got to run. I just picked out an OSR, a very nice little OSR. Is it an OSR? Might be a 5e adventure for D&D, I think, but quite nicely put together. Blissfully easy to convert over to Hjaltanus Tild, no problem at all. I thought, well, I'll use that. Why not? It looks quite nice. It's called a Royal Treat. I think it's a Royal Feast, a Royal Treat, I think it's called. Quite a nice little adventure. And I offered that at UK Games Expo. Now, I went fully expecting no one at all ever to have heard of Hjaltanus Tild, but that's foolish, isn't it? We're a wise and multifarious kind of a group of people, and I actually got a person at the table who had always wanted to play Hjaltanus Tild, you know, another Brit, and hadn't had a huge amount of success in translation, so desperately wanted to play it, and played it and enjoyed it. In fact, for him and his partner, I think they both said it was the best game that they'd played across the whole convention, which is nice to hear, and encouraged him to go off and maybe make something of it. And I obviously shared my character sheet with him so he could use that as well. The game was great in play. It played out as smoothly as you would expect a basic role-playing game to play, One of the defining aspects of a basic role-playing game is how intuitive the game is. What am I good at? Well, after 2 seconds of looking at your character sheet, you know what you're good at and you know what you're not so good at, because it's just a 0 to 100, well, 15 to 100 score on all your different things. Okay, you might argue, and I wouldn't necessarily argue against you, that 27 skills is probably about, 9 too many, or maybe more, maybe 15 too many. But it doesn't seem to matter. It doesn't matter to people in play. You're just tracking different facets at a higher level of granularity than perhaps what you might expect from more modern game design. So that in itself was fine, but always the problem with that is the whiff factor. So I think adventurer skills, the 27, they start at a base of about 15. And although you've got in character generation lots that go up quite a bit, and in your perhaps signature skill, you might be at 80% as a starter character. So don't think you are, scrabbling around at 30s for everything. Far from it. You've got a lot of skills, a lot of key skills anyway, which you're noted for, at which you're actually highly proficient. But you do have a residual scattering in this 27 skills of 15s dotted about, which does feel a little bit low, and indeed it is. Yes, you've got perhaps some chances of flipping, and yes, if you've got an open two roll, then that, or an open one roll, then maybe that'll help you out, but it still feels quite light. There are easy fixes to that if you think it needs fixing. I mean, classically you would say, well, start everyone at 22 at adventurer skills. That would be an easy way around it. I haven't decided whether I'd want to do that or whether I just frankly stick with 15. Might be important for a campaign game to have that sense of progression from beginning. But so I don't know. So there's that as an element. But other than that, in play, it just played out very, very well indeed. So that's the first context, which is actual face-to-face play. The second context was TavernCon. So I put together a little convention for the Tavern Forum, which is a forum where a lot of us sort of hang out and chat. And we got some games in, and I was determined to bring Yaltanis Tild to that. But of course, that meant online. So I have created sheets for character sheets and some supporting sheets for the Roll virtual tabletop, which I've spoken to, I think, before on this podcast, or certainly on YouTube, I've spoken about it. And so we played Yaltanis Tild, a different adventure, online using Roll. And again, fairly good feedback. I mean, the game certainly works well. It works great in Roll. So if ever you wanted to play your Yaltanis Tild, go and play on Roll if you want to. It's got fully linked character sheets in there. Good to go. Really enjoyed it. It won't end there. So I'm not yet at Kraken. I'm going to Kraken in Germany in August. And my game, the game that I'm offering, is, well, Yaltanis Tild. I sort of want to be a Brit running a Swedish role-playing game in English in Germany for Swedes. Now, if I can get that in, I'd be quite happy. So, nicely playing game. It's a nicely playing game. I really think that this game has evoked my customary game tingles. Now, is it an unnecessary segue from more focused application of established game lines that I have? Well, perhaps. Nevertheless, I got my heart flutterings and game excitement with this, which is all to the good. And I have got it to the table, but I would like to do more with it. I genuinely do. It's just enough, It's just enough. It's simple. It plays well. I like it. And I think it brings me back to those early days, but with some nice design conceits, some of which we sort of were fiddling around with, typically using Stormbringer as a base back in the day. So it's reminiscent of our sort of design thinking of the time to create simple to play intuitive games with a little bit of danger, but with a nice touch of magic. And that's what it brings. And so I think I will do more. In fact, it's interesting how one thing leads to another. So the actual play has sort of got me thinking, well, where do I set this game? Because it doesn't really come with a setting. So I brought out my old homebrew setting, which was called Kalan, I'm now going to call it Areth, and the old map. And I got the old map out. And I had been working on the old map using Wonder Draft, which is a mapping package. And I've made a good start on that. And so I created a map. Nice. And then I thought, well, I could print the map out. I could print it on some nice, you know, plastic-like paper that's going to stand the test of time and maybe the odd gamer drink being spilt on it. So I did that. And so it's brought me back into my homebrew world. One thing leading to another. It's really nice, actually. And unsurprisingly, because Yeltana's Tilde comes with, you know, it comes with some design assumptions, this idea of two worlds, drawing magic in from the other world, combat being dangerous, magic being a debt, being a cost to the world. It's not something you can just willy-nilly cast. I like that. Little and no mention of the gods. Are the gods dead? Or do you want to bring in, like, I don't know, some sort of theistic magic with priests and so on? But you have to think about that, because that assumption isn't really there in the game. So it comes with some design assumptions, but it's light and flexible. So you can apply it, I would suggest, quite broadly to, well, almost any game world. And certainly with my homebrew, I could certainly do that with it. So that's nice. So it brings things together. So, Yeltana's Tilde. Nice game, nice in play, and it's got me doing a range of creative things. Translation, a little bit of an understanding of Swedish, but frankly, very, very little. I did wonder, because I've joked about it before, haven't I? Should we all be learning Swedish? I mean, the answer has got to be no. I mean, I think Swedish is about as useful as Sindarin, possibly less, because the Swedes probably speak better English than we do. You know, they're quite happy to, quite comfortable speaking in English. So it's not one of those ones where you're going to learn Swedish and then go on your holidays to Sweden and then show off your fantastic Swedish. I mean, you might do that. And obviously, it's always nice to do that. But the incentive's a little bit less given the English in Sweden. Or you learn it so you can translate Swedish role-playing games better. Now, that is a good reason. There's probably better reasons, but for me, that's a useful reason. So it's got me in the translation side, a bit of a brush with Swedish. It's brought in my homebrew world. It's got me to the table. It's brought the joy of the game to other people. Lots of nice things. And it all comes from, well, it all came from one RPG.net post, a thread, which I looked at and thought, oh, I want to go and have a look at that. And when I did, well, look at me now. This is where I've got to. Yeltana's Tilde. Pretty damn good game. Well, there we are. Oh, good Lord. What on earth have we covered there? We've covered a little bit of how to translate a PDF. It does make you wonder, doesn't it? You know, I don't think games written in another language is necessarily a blocker for you to play them if you can't read the language. I think Google Translate's got to the point now, depending on the layout of the PDF, then you probably can get a sense of it. Or what you could do is just stick to English role-playing games if you're an English speaker, and then you don't have to bother all that rubbish. I mean, honestly, what am I like? I've got shelves of games written in English. So what do? I enthuse about one that I can't even read. Yeah, it's very me. It's very me. I don't know. But I've got a lot of joy out of the process, and I believe I've discovered a game that not many people have heard of. As I say, when I was at UK Games Expo, somebody came to my table who actually had it and wanted to play it. And I mentioned it out loud in another room. And I said, you know, I said it in the way that no one would ever actually heard of it. And someone said, oh, yeah, I do. Yeah, yeah. My brother knows it because he works in Sweden or something. And I do know of it quite well. Whether he played it or not, I don't really know. But it wasn't completely unknown even then. But I suspect it is a game that, whereas I can translate it and play it, and I've done that, it's not one that I can really share. What I would do is, if someone really wanted to play along with me, is I would encourage them to buy the PDFs from Helmgast. They're not a lot of money at all. Very low amount of money. Buy the PDFs from Helmgast, and we'll talk about us sharing translations with those who have bought the actual game. I can't share the translation without that happening, but the investment is low. And then, you know, should you want to, you could play it yourself. I suspect it'll just be me. I'll be this weird, well, I am weird. I'm weird anyway. Weird in both senses of the word. A weird person turning up with a game that no one's ever heard of, or not many have, who can't read it, but can play it. I did actually contact Helmgast and just happened to say, if you happen to be translating Yaltanus Tild, I'd buy it. That probably wasn't enough of a draw for them. And they've probably got other fish to fry. I think they've got other projects on. So I don't actually think this game is, well, possibly ever going to see the light of English-speaking day, which is a shame. But there you go. Now, the final thing I would say about Yaltanus Tild, apart from the obvious, which is, why, Graham? Why? What on earth are you doing? Is Dragonbane. So I'll talk more about KSR another time, but Dragonbane fits very much within the KSR mould of classic Swedish roleplay. And in some ways, Yaltanus Tild and Dragonbane cover very, very similar ground. Light games in that sort of Chaosium influenced, equal to or less than skill, low page count, lowish fantasy in the sense that it's dangerous, kind of a mould with either open worlds, very open worlds with lots of space for you, or basically not focusing on the world and letting you build it and use it yourself, your own world. It's all got that KSR feel about it, but they do overlap. They do overlap, you know, characters with nice abilities based around their kin and their archetype. It is actually the same in Yaltanus Tild. A roll-low mechanic. Nice dice tricks in Yaltanus Tild. Some nice free league flourishes in Dragonbane. They are similar-ish in style. I am getting Dragonbane. I'm going to be doing some more with Dragonbane, which I'll talk about in another podcast. But and Dragonbane I've used as my family game with my grown-up kids, and we love it. So they do intersect quite strongly. There's quite a big overlap. Quite where the balance between Yaltanus Tild and Dragonbane goes, I don't know. I do wonder if Dragonbane in some ways would be better at a convention, in that it's something that people can then get enthused about and go and buy to play, whereas Yaltanus Tild will always be a curiosity which they hopefully will enjoy the session but never actually buy and play themselves. And maybe Yaltanus Tild, therefore, is something that I do for my own games and leave it at that. I thought I'd share that with you. I hope that was of some interest. I will come back relatively soon. I'd like to talk a little bit about KSR, and I'd like to talk about a games mastering project that I have in mind that I would never have conceived that I would do. Never. Until maybe about 6 months ago. And I think I'm going to do it. But on that bombshell, on that tantalising bombshell, I'll leave you. So, thank you very much. Hope you have a great rest of your day. Enjoy your gaming. Take care. And talk soon.